You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
The Athletic.
The only way to score is, of course, to play with a handbrake off.
Hi, I'm Adrian Clark, in for Ian Stone today, and this is Handbrake Off, the Arsenal podcast brought to you by The Athletic. It's the morning after the evening before, and there's a warm red glow about the place, I've got to say. Isn't it good to have Arsenal versus Manchester United back as one of the calendar's true heavyweight fixtures? Isn't it even nicer to beat them with a good old-fashioned winner in Eddie time at the end. We shall thoroughly dissect and debate that Emirates Stadium classic between now and the final whistle on today's show, and ponder who else might come into Mikel Arteta's squad between now and the end of the window. Today, I'm in the company of two of The Athletic's finest writers and football experts. Good morning to Amy Lawrence and Michael Cox. Morning, guys.
Hello. Hi, Adrian.
Hello, hello, hello. Yeah, no Stoney today. Sends his apologies. But yeah, brilliant to see you guys. What a game it was. Absolutely unbelievable. And I don't know, that last minute winner was just a moment, wasn't it? So let's kick off, shall we, today with memorable last minute winners for Arsenal. It's an obvious one, but let's go there, shall we? Amy, I've got a feeling I know which one you might pick. So maybe can we go for two from you?
Yeah, I can't ever answer this question without Michael Thomas and 1989 being at the front of my brain. So that's my all-time fave. But I'll give a shout out to Andy Linnigan winning the FA Cup in 1993 in the replay. And, you know, nice bit of unsung hero about it as well. And I think you need that in teams of winners. So that felt pertinent as well because... you know, the way that Eddie has come in really complicated circumstances and shown that maybe people who had worries shouldn't have worried quite so much. Still a long way to go on that front as well, but it was just a phenomenal moment for him. I think to be the man that delivers that kind of significance of goal, because the difference between a 2-2 and a 3-2 in that game in terms of the psyche of the team, I think, is monumental.
Yeah, I tend to agree. Scrappy last-minute winners where it's a little bit of the ball bobbling around in the box. Just feels even better as well, doesn't it? Coxie, what have you got for us?
The one that came to mind for me was Thierry Henry's header against Manchester United in 2007. Obviously, the similar opposition helps. And, I mean, it wasn't a momentous season for Arsenal, that 2006-2007, but it was the first season at the Emirates. And I think of that as the first really big moment at the Emirates. And I think for a club to get a new stadium in it, to feel like home, you do need those huge moments. And yeah, that was a standout moment from an otherwise quite forgettable season for Arsenal.
Yeah, absolutely. On it feeling like home, by the way, let's sort of expand on that while we brought it up. That stadium, Amy, is just so together at the moment, isn't it? Everybody stayed behind at the end for what seemed an age, I felt anyway. We were trying to kick off our post-match debrief on the breakdown live, and we just delayed it because the punters that were in our studio audience, they did not want to come in. They didn't want to leave the sort of auditorium. You know, the stadium was still alive 2 or 3 minutes after kickoff. Really special.
Yeah, I noticed that as well, actually. It was kind of, you know, the sneak off to grab the tube... people were definitely less inclined. There wasn't so much on the early exits. And I think everybody just wanted to savour and relish the feeling. It was very emotional and there was charge. I mean, did you look at Zinchenko's face? Like, I did find that I was just watching people for a little bit after the final whistle. I was just looking at people's body language and their faces, and... It's just not, it's just, I wouldn't say not normal, that doesn't sound right, but it's taken people into a place that they haven't been to before for a long time. And you can see how much everyone cares, and that comes from the top, it comes from Arteta, it filters through the players, and it courses through into the stands. And then I think it kind of somehow feeds through the ether to all the Arsenal fans all over the world who are feeling it as well. There is a very strong vibe. I don't know how much you can say that things like that actually can carry you further than you would ordinarily go. They're imponderables. You can't kind of calculate the impact of things like that. But it certainly seems to be the wind in Arsenal's sails at the moment, I think, that vibration.
Yeah, it isn't normal. You were right at the start there. It isn't normal. These feelings, these moments, that kind of connection doesn't come around too often. And it's a long, long time, I think, since Arsenal fans have felt this warm and fuzzy about the team. I had a fan tweet me last night saying, I've been an Arsenal fan for 60 years and I can't remember ever liking an Arsenal team more than I like this one. And I just went, wow. What high praise that is. And I think it kind of sums up where we are. On last minute winners, I mean, it's not the same, but there is a game that ebbed and flowed in a really similar way to this Manchester United one, where we went behind, we came back quite quickly, and then it toed and froze. And in the end, we won it with a last minute winner. It was in the 1997-98 double winning season. And my mate Nigel Winterburn, absolutely love Nige, and he just lashed. I mean, fans of a certain age will remember it. He came onto the ball and lashed the ball outside of the foot into the top corner against Chelsea at Stamford Bridge in the last minute. And we went on to win the double. Don't know. If we win on Friday night, we're going to have to start talking about doubles. Let's not go there just yet. Let's not get too carried away.
Listen, we've not got Stoney on today. Come on, Adrian. There's not a necessity that you have to actually start going all over the top already just because you're in the Stoney shoes exactly. Today. Come on. You know you're nice and calm.
Here's Trossard now. Uses Zinchenko. Zinchenko's ball across. Odegaard. Stamped in by Nketiah.
Arsenal 3, Manchester United 2, it was an absolutely phenomenal match to watch. Definitely lived up to the hype. And Eddie and Saka, we've touched on them a little bit already. Hale End FC, the two boys, were the stars of the show, weren't they? Let's get to them first up then. Michael, let's start with you. Bukayo Saka, another special performance, another great goal. And it wasn't easy for him, wasn't it, Michael? Because he was up against Luke Shaw, arguably the most informed left back in the division, and he had to stick at it. But it was worth it, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I thought he was really intelligent, Saka, with the way he varied his positioning. I agree that Luke Shaw's been playing well, actually played well for a period at centre-back as well. But I was surprised. I mean, Marcus Rashford either wasn't asked to defend or couldn't be bothered to defend because there was so much space for Saka. I mean, he could just drag Shaw all over the place. If he wanted to take him wide, he could. If he wanted to go inside, he could. And, you know, he obviously scored that fantastic goal and then nearly replicated it, didn't he, about 15 minutes later. And I think when you see something like that happening twice, you've got to ask questions from Manchester United's point of view. But yeah, he's gone to the next level, Saka. I mean, I think from the moment he came into the side, I mean, at left back initially was where I remember him playing. He clearly showed great potential. But I think this level of efficiency and this goal-scoring ability and just his capacity for doing different things, you know, he can come inside and shoot with his left, but he's also very effective at going down the line, and he scored against Leeds with the goal going down the line and using his right foot. So, yeah, he's a nightmare for opposition fullbacks at the moment, and I thought he was, you know, in a very good team performance, I thought he was man of the match by a mile.
Yeah, Amy, what were your thoughts on Bukayo? We are running out of superlatives. That goal has to be right up there with one of his best, if not his best.
Well, I actually made a quite embarrassingly high-pitched noise when that went in, because it's quite awkward sometimes in the press box. Obviously, you have to behave yourself. And I think it was that sort of I couldn't stop it, the noise coming out, but it wasn't supposed to be a kind of full-blown, you know, yell. So it went up a few more octaves than normal. I may have sounded like I was being strangled. I don't know. So apologies, anyone in the vicinity. But yeah, it was a very, very special goal. And I think it needed special goal in a game like that, because I just felt it was a very tense match. And it did have those senses, those sensations of old Arsenal Man United games more closely. And anybody who had the pleasure of sitting through even a few minutes of the Liverpool-Chelsea game the day before on telly, the contrast was so extreme, and it actually stopped me in my tracks a bit, because it wasn't that long ago that I felt like you'd watch Arsenal play and then you'd watch Liverpool or Chelsea or Man City or whoever was leading the way in the last few years and think, oh, they're playing a totally different sport, really. It just felt agonisingly different. And the tables seemed entirely flipped, because I would have thought if you're a Chelsea or Liverpool fan who sat through that game and then turned around and watched Man United Arsenal, they probably would have been feeling very aware of how far off the highest standards are at the moment in the Premier League. And I credit Man United. I think you could see their improvement. You know, they felt to me like the sternest test Arsenal faced at the Emirates thus far. And it just fell on that knife edge. And so when a goal like Saka's comes along to swing it, or indeed Nketiah's second goal, and even the first to make the equaliser, you know, when you are living on that knife edge, you know, you feel everything so much more sharply. But Saka, what I love about watching him that fascinates me somewhat is that he manages to at once play with this kind of rapid intensity, but also looks relaxed. It's almost like a trick of the eye. I'm not quite sure how he does that. And I think a lot of great players have that capacity to look completely focused and in their zone, but also relaxed at the same time. You know, I think of a Zidane, for example.
He's comfortable at
the
level.
When you feel at one with what you're doing, when you're comfortable in your own skin, when your confidence levels are high, when you've got not carrying any fear. Obviously, his mentality, his psychology about the game is probably just almost as remarkably advanced as the way he plays the game for a boy of his age.
Yeah, absolutely. And he was very cool and calm and funny in the post-match interview, wasn't he? Because, of course, he became the third Arsenal player to score in three consecutive Premier League matches against Manchester United, Freddie Ljungberg and Thierry Henry, the others.
Yes, I'm happy I accepted the challenge. You know, hello, Freddie, hello, Thierry.
In the post-match, absolutely love that. His awareness of the achievement was impressive as well, I thought.
And they were both there to watch, which is nice.
Exactly. It was a star-studded affair, that is for sure. I know you tweeted half an hour after the game that you were struggling to speak, Amy. I had to go and do the breakdown live analysis. I was a little bit wobbly for the first couple of minutes or so. It was one of those evenings. And I know that Stoney, who was there watching the game, was emotional too. his first two, he wanted to send us a voice note, and the first two he did send, but we'll never hear them because he deleted them before producer Abby had a chance to listen to them. So we'll never know what he was feeling in the immediate aftermath. But Stoney did compose himself and he sent us a lovely voice note. Let's listen to it now.
Hello. Well, I've taken about an hour and a half to let me calm down after Arsenal 3 Manchester United to a pulsating Emirates. One of the most brilliant atmospheres I've been in quite some time. And this team keep producing, don't they? It's the belief that I think is most impressive. You know, when they're letting an early goal to Marcus Rashford, they didn't let it faze them at all. They just kept playing their game, equalised within 10 minutes. And even when it went to 2-2 in the second half, we've been attacking for most of that half. We just kept playing, kept going at them, and got, I think, a deserved win in the end. Three players I want to mention. Eddie Nketiah, two more goals. I don't know what that is, five now in six or seven games. Absolutely no worries about Gabriel Jesus not being in the team now. It's just absolutely brilliant to see Eddie doing so well. It's all he's ever wanted to do is lead the line for Arsenal, and I'm so chuffed for him. And the first goal, particularly the header, was great. Bukayo Saka, obviously. I mean, you know, we're running out of superlatives to talk about Bukayo. But what a superstar. And that one time when he knew he didn't have to take on Luke Shaw, because that was a tough matchup for Bukayo. And he had Christian Eriksen in front of him, and he came inside and buried it in the bottom corner. Great goal. And the third player is Oleksandr Zinchenko. I mean, I know he's been interviewed and talked about dreaming about the title, and said that when he mentioned that at the start of the season, people laughed. But no one is laughing now. He is such a fabulous player, and he's a winner as well. And he's lifted the atmosphere of the whole place. I'm very, very impressed with him. And I know what people think about me on the podcast, that I get carried away. I want to get carried away. I think the point is that this team has basically given us enough for us to get carried away. We're 19 games in, we're halfway through the season, we're 5 points clear with a game in hand from Manchester City, a team owned by a nation state. And we've just gone 11 points clear of Manchester United with a game in hand, I believe. I mean, this is unbelievable stuff from the boys. And I enjoyed it very much.
I did bump into Stoney briefly after the game, and as I was saying before, looking at people's faces, I find really amazing at the moment. And his face looked sort of strangely ethereal. He was in another celestial world, that boy. That's for sure. I wish I'd taken a photo.
Brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Michael, let's talk a little bit more about Eddie Nketiah, because there were so many doubts about him when he was asked to step up to the plate in Gabriel Jesus' absence. He has impressed greatly, hasn't he? I mean, it's 7 goals in his last 7 starts in all competitions. I thought it was another outstanding performance. Even if he hadn't have scored, I think he still played ever so well. He was always looking for the ball. He was working ever so hard. What do you make of his development as a player?
Yeah, I think even those who had some level of faith in Nketiah will still have been surprised at how well he's done. I think the thing I like about Nketiah, and I realise this might sound like a backhanded compliment, but he knows his limitations. He's I'd say, a relatively simple player. He's good at one or two things, but he really maximises those. I mean, I don't think there's many players in the Premier League who are better in the 6-yard box, as we saw for the winner. And I've also been so impressed by the way he receives the ball on the turn. You know, he's not necessarily a player who's going to be dropping deep and spraying passes out wide, but just his ability to roll defenders, I think, just makes, you know, nothing situations into potential goal-scoring chances. So he's done really well. He's a different type of player to Jesus, but I think Arsenal as a whole have adjusted well. It's not just him that's done well. I think Arsenal have adjusted well in certain ways they play in the final third. So, yeah, it's been a great success story for Arsenal. And, you know, when Jesus got injured, there would have been a lot of people saying Arsenal need to go into the transfer market for another forward. Obviously, Trossard's come in a different type of player, but I don't think anyone would consider that at the moment because he's just done so well.
No, he's been outstanding. Our friends at Opta tweeted after Eddie's first goal, and that it was at the time 36 senior club goals, 19 came from inside the 6-yard box. We can count that as 20 now, and 37 senior goals in total from him. That's, you know, he is the fox in the box, isn't he, Amy? I thought, actually, even though the build-up to that dramatic winner was a bit scrambly, the improvisation from him was really clever.
But I think that what has most pleased people, and probably Eddie himself as well, is that he's had to prove that he's more than a fox in the box, I think. And in fairness to Arteta, one thing you would say is that he has been committed to Eddie from the beginning. You know, bringing him back from Leeds when he was first appointed, that was a bit of a surprise move. And consistently showing faith and singing his praises. And whether that was, you know, it's hard to say exactly whether he's just saying what he sees or whether he's trying to do things for an effect, he has had a great loyalty to Eddie. And like you say, I think there have been various points at which he either could have maybe gone or somebody could have come in as well, particularly lately. But to carry this... I think when Jesus was out, the first thing really I almost did when looking at the fixtures was these three fixtures screamed out at me. Newcastle, yeah, home, I could see a lot of goals. Tottenham away, not a happy hunting ground in the last 10 years or so. And Man United at home, who are, you know, improving. And that was where I found myself wondering whether Arsenal would have enough goals in them for those matches. And I think the only criticism is that they didn't quite against Newcastle and probably had a player of Trossard's calibre or Smith Rowe been further down the road to fitness been available at that stage. It might have been enough to tip it in the same way that, you know, Trossard coming on did have an impact yesterday. It did change the attacking dynamic and give Man United something extra to worry about. And that you had someone with the technical quality and the, you know, he was comfortable enough to run at them quite confidently from the get-go. It was part of that grandstand finish. But to have come through those three tests with 7 points and maybe a little unlucky not to be more because they were the better team against Newcastle, in the absence of Jesus, I think it's a thing that is... it's a massive building block for this team in their development. And, you know, the next one, obviously, is Man City are on over the horizon in two different competitions.
But what will happen, Amy, is that we've delivered in those games, particularly the last two, where we could have scored more. Let's face it, Manchester United had a lot of last-ditch tackles in the game. Eddie Nketiah could easily have had a hat-trick with that half volley that really he probably should have found the corner from that De Gea pushed away. Against Spurs, I think we could all see that we could have had five there. I do think that this team will now believe they can go to the Etihad or entertain City at home and really get after them, don't you? Amy, I'll go to
don't
you.
Don't you think that the critical factor is keeping as many of these people fit and sharp as possible? And I did think, and I quite like Michael's view on this, Tomiyasu coming on at halftime for Ben White was quite indicative of being able to use the squad in a way that I think Mikel Arteta has been a bit reluctant to. He doesn't want to mess about with his so-called sort of first picks too much. But he came in and actually changed the dynamic a little bit.
Yeah, I thought White had a bit of a difficult first half actually against Rashford, who's also on a yellow card as well. And I think that's another positive for Arsenal is the fact that, you know, at the start of Arteta's reign, discipline was a big issue. Arsenal were getting a lot of red cards. They haven't got a single red card this season. Yesterday was the game where if you got a fifth booking of the season, players would be suspended. And Arsenal have ended with Saliba, Gabriel, Saka and White all on 4 yellow cards. So they've really, you know...
sailed close to the wind. Yeah,
little bit nervy. But it's just little things like that that... It's almost hard to find a phrase for this because people think you're saying Arsenal or whatever team are being lucky. It's not being lucky, but there's just so many little things that are just going Arsenal's way. Like the winner yesterday. I mean, I thought Arsenal were the better side and really could have won that by 2 or 3 goals, but also they came very close to drawing it and they didn't. And I think when a side goes on to win the league in unexpected fashion, I think of Leicester in the same way. I know it's a different kettle of fish, but it was just so many last minute winners, so many things where you just thought, that's gone their way. And, you know, to get 50 points after 19 games, I mean, I don't think there's much chance of Arsenal sustaining that. But even if they get 40, 45 points in the second 19 of games, which of course features 2 games against Manchester City, I think they've got a very good chance of winning the league.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought up that sort of mentality, because there is a point in some games where you get to the last throes of it, the last 10 minutes, and you think, well, if we can't win it, let's not lose it. And Manchester United had that feeling. Erik ten Hag had that feeling because he made the substitution with Antony and he brought on Fred. He went defensive, but here we didn't. We kept pushing and pushing and pushing. It was relentless, wasn't it, in that second half? And that's one of the qualities I love most about this Arsenal team, is that desire to keep going and break the opposition through relentless, sustained pressure. Now, I've got a stat for you. We had 63 touches in Manchester United's box in the entire game. An amazing stat. 41 of those came during the second half. And I got on the hotline to our pals at Upton straight after the game. And I said, this feels like it might be a record. Can you tell me if Arsenal have ever done that against a Big Six team? And the answer is no. Not since records began for this particular stat, which is only going back to 2008, 2009. But that's domination and that is winning mentality, is it not, Amy?
It is, but it's I think it was a bit stream of consciousness what I tried to put together from the game yesterday. I said I can't speak, and anybody who knows the old rugby league clip knows exactly what I mean. I had a few people on Twitter saying, well, you can't spell either. It's like, okay. But, you know, your brain feels a bit scrambled because there's so much going on. And as Michael said, there were so many little details that were interesting as well. But I think that kind of winning mentality, I called Mikel Arteta, a winning mentality monster or words to that effect. And, you know, I'm struggling to overstate how impressed I am with how much he's changed this team and this club in the time that he's done it. And when you think back to him coming in, it seems preposterous that this man walked into a club as a young man taking on his first job in management, sitting here today. Just seems so improbable. It's ridiculous to have engineered this level of turnaround. And it's, you know, as we all saw in the Amazon documentary, he has a very particular level of standards, determination, obsessiveness. Mm. And I do think that he is desperate to win every game. And I know you would obviously say that about most managers, but I think he does take it to that nth degree. And, you can imagine him like bolt upright in the middle of the night. I mean, I hope he sleeps well, but, you know, just like brain fizzing with thoughts and ideas about details that might help his team and motivate his team. And it seems like the way he is has just filtered straight through into his players because they carry that with them. They're young. They should be a bit scared at times. They should be a bit overwhelmed. And somehow they're not at the moment.
They're not. He's raised standards across the board. And Michael, bringing up the discipline side of it, I think ties in with that. Because I think if you have high standards across everything you do, then you're more disciplined on and off the pitch as well. Michael, what's your take on Mikel Arteta's learning on the job? It's been spectacular.
It has. And I think there's an interesting contrast with Manchester United. I know they're not managed by Solskjaer anymore, but of course they were for a couple of years until, 14 months ago or something. And in a way, they were similar. In a sense, they weren't that experienced and they came in with a big thing that they know the club. But I think they approached it in completely different ways. Solskjaer was at Manchester United at a time where they were hugely successful. And everything he did and said was geared around trying to make the club as he remembered it when he was there as a player. I think the thing about Arteta is, I always got the impression he was really frustrated when he was at Arsenal. I think he thought there was a lack of standards. There was not enough kind of tactical understanding that came from the top down, and basically just a lack of focus that he almost certainly discovered when he went to Manchester City. And, you know, he never won a league title as a player, but he went to City and he was part of that. And it's almost like the way that he knows the club was he knew what he wanted to change about the club. And it's just so different. I mean, everything about the composition of the squad, the mentality in the stadium, the age of the side, it's been a huge rebuilding job, really. And, you know, there's been times where it's been difficult. I mean, I think everyone's now shifting to saying it's good that Arsenal had patience with Arteta, and absolutely it is. There was a time in winter 2021 where I think it was slightly difficult to see what the plan was and where things were going. But the improvement this season, this tends to happen, I think, when a manager's rebuilding a club. You think you go from a 5 out of 10 to a 6 out of 10 to a 7 out of 10 club. Often it just goes from kind of average to brilliant overnight. I think that happened with Klopp's Liverpool to a certain extent. And it seems to have happened with Arteta and Arsenal.
Do you think, what do you think about what Michael said there about his frustrations during his time as a player here and ways that he thought he could improve things. Is that fair? Is that a fair point?
Fascinating. I felt like I was sitting here nodding away to absolutely everything Michael was saying. And it's such an interesting angle to take on it all. And I think it's bang on that contrast between, you know, Solskjaer trying to kind of recreate something and Arteta trying to create something entirely new, you know, take best practices, his own ideas. And I don't think it's as simple as saying that what he's doing at Arsenal is a recreation of Man City either. You know, I think obviously a lot is interpreted in his education that he had and the experience he had under Guardiola at Man City. But I don't think that what he's done at Arsenal is a sort of is a direct copy at all. I think he's put his own fingerprints on it too, which makes it even more interesting.
Yeah, links in nicely to where I wanted to take us next, and that is Oleksandr Zinchenko, one of the players that he worked with, of course, at Manchester City. He's come in and obviously it's a stop-start beginning to life as an Arsenal player because of injury, but we are really seeing a footballer now, aren't we, Coxie? I mean, he is one of my favourite players to watch just because he's so unique in the way that he goes about his work in this hybrid left-back central midfield position. An absolute natural for it, and he seems a really good lad as well, a real interesting character. Zinchenko, discuss. Tell me more about him and your observations.
Yeah, I agree with you. He's a fascinating player because he's almost been built in this mould to be half fullback, half central midfielder. I mean, we didn't see him much as a proper central midfielder for Manchester City. I actually didn't realise how good he was until I watched the Ukraine against Scotland World Cup playoff in June, I think it was. And I couldn't believe how good he was. I couldn't believe how well he commanded the game. He played almost like a Martin Odegaard figure in that game, which obviously he has to be a bit more reserved with Arsenal. But no, he's been fantastic. But it's, to a certain extent, it's about individuals. But it is, let's be honest, him and Gabriel Jesus, the two players who, to a certain extent, have transformed Arsenal. Let's be honest, they were Manchester City rejects, really. And for Arteta to get those two players and use, to transform a side who finished fifth last season into a side who at the halfway point are ahead of Manchester City is incredible. And it is all a team performance. At the start of the campaign, I don't think many neutrals would have put together a Premier League 11 and had any Arsenal player in it. I mean, Saka's a great player. People wouldn't have had him ahead of Salah. Odegaard's a great player. People wouldn't have had him ahead of De Bruyne. And yet Arsenal are midway through on 50 points. It's incredible, really.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, if something happened to Thomas Partey and he was out injured, would you use Zinchenko, Amy, in that particular position? Do you think he would be able to do it? Obviously, he's completely opposite in terms of stature. Do you think that's the most logical solution or not? Because I think he's someone that could pretty much play anywhere on the pitch.
Yeah, I think that was the thing that was sort of swirling around in my mind for a while now, because it didn't look or sound like Arsenal were in the market for another midfield player either last summer or in this January window. Obviously the Declan Rice slightly intriguing situation adds a little bit of fuel to that sense of waiting. So if you have to find an internal solution, Zinchenko looks like sort of probably the most obvious. But of course the flip side of that is losing what he brings from the position that he plays in currently. And although he's ostensibly, you know, a left back, he has this freedom to pop up all over the place. And in particularly did yesterday, I think he was even more adventurous in the game against Man United, because it just looked like it meant so much to him personally. He just looked like I felt like whatever he's on, I wouldn't mind trying it type of stuff. It was like, it was wild out there.
Do you think he made it to Match of the Day like he promised he would?
I don't think he would have gone to sleep. I think he would have gone home, watched everything he could watch, been on and off all the social media that he fancied, and, you know, on his phone to his friends and what have you. I'm sure. When you're as full of adrenaline as he must have been at the end of that, I don't think he goes home and just puts his feet up.
I don't think so. I think Mikel wanted to give the players a day off. I think he knew it was important, even though they're playing on Friday. I think he knew that they needed a day off today. They were out on the pitch the players that weren't involved.
I thought you were going to say out on something else there.
No, okay. It sounded like it, didn't it? But no, they were out on the pitch doing quite a heavy sort of warm down afterwards. So I think that's the thinking, just switch off for a day. And I think him and a number of the players would absolutely have needed to do that. Michael, I know you've written a piece about wingers from the game. It's out on The Athletic at the moment. Tell us a bit more about that.
I watched the game live and I thought it was a good, relatively close game that Arsenal deserved to win. And I watched the game again and I thought Arsenal were miles better. I thought they created so many more chances. That stat you mentioned about getting the ball into the box was interesting. I think the contrast between the teams, and hopefully I've explained this in the article, is just the defensive shape. I mean, for all Arsenal's attacking spark, Saka and Martinelli worked really hard without the ball to get back and protect the fullbacks. And you just didn't have that for Manchester United. You know, Rashford and Anthony, to a certain extent, kind of just walk back into positions. And the funny thing with Arsenal is it's not just the wingers that benefit from that, because Odegaard drifts really wide. He doesn't really play like a number 10, does he? He plays inside right, and Xhaka's more like an inside left. And those players just had so much space. I mean, the number of clips I found where Odegaard, who I think has been close to the best player in the league this season, is in 15 yards of space, just desperately appealing for a pass, and Manchester United just not shutting him down. I mean, for me, that was the big lesson from Manchester United's perspective. Arsenal just work really hard without the ball. They've got a good shape, a deep, compact shape. And to kind of reiterate something which Amy said about Arsenal not just being a clone of Manchester City, I think they're a bit tougher and they're a bit more old school without possession. They get back into a 4-4-2 and they get everyone behind the ball. And OK, they press well at times. But just that deep, compact shape, I think, is, partly explains the good defensive record. And yeah, that's something you just didn't see from Manchester United at all.
Yeah, Georgie Graham's Arsenal lives on, doesn't it? In a way, there is that spirit, that resilience, that we shall not be moved mentality. I can see it from the stands, no doubt about it. 19 games gone then, 50 points on the board. Amy, what's the second half got in store for us? what should we be aiming for from where we're at?
Get that off of me. One game at a time, Clarkie. No. I'm not going down that road.
You're still going with that. That's fine.
It's far too early.
But if the standards are maintained.
Yeah, but that's such a huge if. I mean, I think you've got to also... there is a natural shift in temperature, if you like, of a season between the first and second half of a season. The fact that any competitions that you happen to be involved in are knockout, obviously it was the Europa League group stage before, it's now... I'm quite intrigued by how Mikel Arteta manages, you know, the whole, if you like, of what's in store in the second half of the season. Because, you know, with his win monster head on, he will want to try and win every game, and that includes the Europa League. Now, I don't know how feasible it is for this squad to be going hell for leather in the Europa and the Premier League at this same pace. We don't know what's going to happen in the FA Cup yet as well either, but theoretically that could still be ongoing. And again, what kind of team is he picking for that game on Friday night in regards to the kind of bigger picture of where Arsenal are and looking after players to manage this? I wouldn't say one-off opportunity, but it feels like an extremely rare opportunity for Arsenal to be in. You know, when you look at the clubs around and the state of the Premier League and the finances and the quality of player that becomes available to all sorts of clubs and the commitment to rebuilds that go on all over the place, a little like that Leicester season in 2016, it feels like one that's a bit too good not to seize. Because you can't be sure that it's going to come along again in the next few years, no matter how good Arsenal feel at the moment. So that's a kind of long-winded, probably, way of just being cautious and enjoying the moment, which is exactly the way that I'm trying to do it, not get too far ahead of anything. It's way too early. And I think even the opponents that you're playing in the second half of the season, there's a different temperature to those games because they've got their own stuff going on. Everything feels more on that knife edge, a bit like yesterday, than in the first half of the season. So, yeah, I think expecting another 50 points is unrealistic. But, you know, whether 40 is achievable and where that takes you, I just want to be open-minded and hope for the best.
Exactly. Enjoy the moment. I think cautious optimism is the best way forward. And what you're talking about there just stresses the importance again to beef up the squad in this January transfer window as much as we possibly can. We'll be talking about that next. You're listening to Handbrake Off, the Arsenal podcast, brought to you by The Athletic.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
We were a bit with the handbrake at time.
I'm Adrian Clark, alongside Amy Lawrence and Michael Cox. Brilliant to have your company on this warm, fuzzy morning, afternoon, evening, whatever time you're listening. We are basking in the glow of another great victory for the Gunners, this time 3-2 at home to Manchester United. But let's talk squad depth and the makeup of Mikel Arteta's group. Leandro Trossard has come in. We touched on him briefly earlier on in the pod, Michael, but it seems like a real smart signing to me, someone that can cover centre forward and left wing in particular.
Yeah, I think he's a very good player. I've always thought he's a player who could step up to one of the bigger clubs in the Premier League. I didn't necessarily think it would be Arsenal, just because I don't think Arsenal always sign this type of player in terms of his age. But yeah, he's a kind of ready-made player, which I think is what Arsenal kind of need, considering the situation in the season at the moment. And I thought, actually, Martinelli, I think he's had a pretty good season so far. I think he's very useful, considering Jesus is out and he can go in behind and score goals. I think his last couple of games, he's been a bit quiet as well. So I think just having another option on the left probably works well for Arsenal. But yeah, I think it's a pretty positive signing.
Yeah, he ran out of ideas a little bit in terms of beating Wan-Bissaka, I thought, in the game. Wan-Bissaka, who was kind of culpable for two of the goals by switching off. But I think in general, in 1v1s against Martinelli, he handled himself pretty well. Now, Amy, me and you have been banging the drum for another striker for what feels like years. he is a striker. Is he number three striker? Does this sort of satisfy you? In terms of that we actually don't need another number nine now. We've got Jesus, we've got Nketiah, we've got Trossard. We do have Martinelli as an option if we need him. Is that enough now? Can we stop talking about it?
Hopefully. I definitely feel much more comfortable about it, that a player of his, like Michael says, ready-made stature is available and he can play across the front line and cover in all sorts of ways. And I'm also really encouraged that Smith Rowe is getting closer and closer by each passing week to, you know, being able to bring his special qualities. You know, I do think you have to be able to change games up. You know, we're living in an era now with these enormous substitutes benches and you need to use them. We need to look after the shape of the team and the individual fitness of everybody, you know, involved. And if you can give little breaks here and there to players who have been relied upon absolutely virtually every minute of every game, really important players, then I think that's really such a big help. So I was pleased with that signing, even though I'm not going to lie and say that the Mudryk thing doesn't still hurt a little bit. because while I think Trossard looks like a man very much for the present, Mudryk clearly would have been someone for the present and the future. And he does look like his potential kind of levels are, you know, really exciting.
His ceiling's so high. He's so quick, Mudryk.
You can see why Arsenal gave it everything that they had, put it that way. But I think given that fell through, the fact that they were able to get someone in as quickly as they did, who fitted the kind of criteria that Trossard fits, was well played. And obviously now there's more expected any moment now at the time of recording. You know, we're expecting to hear things are signed and sealed on Kivior. Is that how you say it? I believe so.
I think so, yeah. Yeah, Jakub Kivior, 22, Poland international. We're signing him from Spezia, apparently for £17.5 million plus add-ons. Obviously, yeah, that Mudryk money, we've got a bit of spare change knocking around. It makes sense, doesn't it, to beef up that bench and strengthen the areas where we're a bit light. And left-side centre-back, Michael, is a position that we don't really have a natural cover for. Gabriel has played pretty much every game this season. I don't know how much you know about Kivior, but the bits I've seen, he looks aggressive. He looks like a proper defender, but also someone that can add that balance in the left side centre back.
Yeah, I thought I wasn't at all aware of him. And then I realised actually I must have seen him play against Argentina at the 974 stadium in Doha last month, which I must say I don't have any recollection of whatsoever. But yeah, I mean, he's another young player.
That's a good thing, right? He's a defender. Yeah. You didn't notice him that much,
yeah, so, I do agree. Yeah. He didn't get embarrassed by Messi or anything like that. So yeah, it seems the right kind of mould of player, doesn't it? I expect a player who probably won't play much this season. I just think unless there's an injury, Arteta will try and keep that defence intact. But yeah, maybe one for the future.
Another one for the future, Amy, could be a young teenager, right back, Real Valladolid, right back, Ivan Fresneda. It's a shootout by all accounts between Arsenal and Borussia Dortmund to land him. About £13 million is the price. He'll be loaned immediately back to the La Liga club should he join us. But again, it's just building blocks for the future, isn't it? I suppose, how many right backs do we need? That's what some people might say. But if there's a good young un around and available that might be ready in a year or two's time, it makes sense to go in for them,
right? Not necessarily in a year or two's time. I mean, I think that it's part of Arteta's quite aggressive vision, really. That is, if he sees someone that he envisages being a serious player, he just wants to get them in and, you know, deal with that later. I mean, you know, I still think it was not that long ago that Arsenal's new look back four, which had Kieran Tierney and Tomiyasu in it, was the talk of the town. And yeah, those are two players that have struggled a little bit for game time this season. And, you know, Arsenal are top of the league. It's very difficult to argue. So I think if you are ruthless, and Arteta is, then if he sees something that he likes, that he thinks is going to be an improvement, because he doesn't want things that are as good as what you've got. He wants things that are better. I'd say the Trossard deal is slightly exceptional circumstances, but certainly when you look at Mudryk and you look at Kivior and you look at Fresneda, then that's the sort of thing that is the next phase of developing what has to be a squad that can manage Premier League and Champions League next season. You can't be playing your second string in the Champions League, obviously. So that's where I think there's a bigger picture strengthening going on. It's not just about right now.
Okay. Well, with that in mind then, guys, I know that transfer news isn't your, you know, strongest area of expertise, either of you, but do you think that's it? Or do you think there'll be one, you know, another surprise between now and the window? What's your gut telling you?
I think if they see another person or they've got their eyes on someone else that they like, who's affordable, who's available, they'll try and do it. But I think they can also be pretty satisfied with what they've managed to achieve so far.
Yeah, definitely. Before we wrap things up, just wanted to bring up the women's team briefly. Their match at Brighton was postponed yesterday. It was one of a raft of games that were called off pretty late, you got to say, due to frozen pitches. Obviously, the Chelsea-Liverpool game actually kicked off, and then just, I think, 7 minutes into the match, the referee deemed it unplayable, which seems farcical, given that during the warm-up, they agreed to go ahead with the match, and earlier on in the day that it passed a pitch inspection. So, yeah, not great, not a good look for the WSL. And I know that there are pieces up on The Athletic about this. Michael, what's your take on this and the talk or the anger that's out there that the women's teams aren't getting the investment in undersoil heating? Should Arsenal, for example, you know, pay for undersoil heating at Boreham Wood to ensure this kind of thing doesn't happen moving forward? The same with Chelsea at Kings Meadow. What's your view on this?
Well, I was actually at Kings Meadow yesterday for the Chelsea-Liverpool 6 or 7 minutes. And I must say, I'm pleased it got called off for various reasons. One, it was exceptionally cold. Two, of course, the safety of the players. But three, we weren't going to get a good game of football because the players were sliding around. I mean, it was a farcical situation, really. I think the undersoil heating is maybe a slightly more complex debate than it would appear. Of course, we all want investment into women's football. But, I mean, if Arsenal pay for Boreham Wood to have undersoil heating, I'm not sure how long Arsenal women will be playing at Boreham Wood. I think if attendances keep on being maintained at the current level, they'll just outgrow it and they'll play at the Emirates. And then Boreham Wood are left with... It's actually quite expensive to just run and have undersoil heating at your ground, I believe, even if you're not using it. So, to be honest, I think the solution is, in the long term, for the women's side to be playing more regularly at a club's main ground. But yeah, the way it was handled yesterday at Chelsea was pretty farcical. And I wasn't actually working, but since I was there, I kind of, and you know, was asked to speak to a few Liverpool fans who'd made the journey down. And cool, but I mean, they'd set off at 5 a.m. They'd had a 6-hour coach journey. Yes. They'd been following the Twitter updates on the way and obviously were overjoyed when it said game on. And then they get 7 minutes and they're back home. And they had to wait as well because the coach driver had to take a 1.5 hour break or whatever it was. they had to wait for him to drive them back. And I think the worst thing is next weekend, Liverpool FA Cup away at Chelsea again. So I'm not sure how many of them will be making the journey next week.
Yeah, the Chelsea players didn't put money behind the bar.
I know, I was. I'm assuming. Great gesture by Lotta Webber-Moore. I thought that was class, especially because the Arsenal men's game was on the TV, so they could enjoy that. No, that was a great gesture. I feel slightly aggrieved I didn't get the same from any Chelsea players. Although Emma Hayes offered everyone a free hot dog at the rearranged fixture, so I will take her up on that.
Yeah, so you should. I love it. Yeah, we got good eggs, haven't we, in the men's team and in the women's team by the sound of it. Well done, Lotta Webber-Moore. Right, let's have a song to finish, shall we? Really enjoyed the show. Really enjoyed yesterday. What's the song, Amy, that you want us to play out on tonight?
I've gone for a song by Eddie Grant because I thought Eddie deserved something. And Electric Avenue. Fair. We're going to rock down to Electric Avenue and then we'll take it higher.
Oh no, we're going to rock down to Electric Avenue and then we'll take it higher. Oh, we're going to rock down to Electric Avenue and then we'll take it higher.
Yeah, it's going to happen. Michael, what's your song?
I was trying to think of something with the word 50 in or halfway, you know. Nice. I'm not sure I can go for
halfway
any.
There.
I did think of that, but I can't really stand that song, to be honest. And I also don't want anything by 50 Cent either. So I'm afraid I don't have anything, but Electric Avenue is a great shout. Let's go for that.
Yeah, you can steal Amy's. Yeah, mine is Love Is Noise from The Verve. Used to love The Verve. And just at the final whistle there was a lot of noise. There was a lot of love inside the Emirates. It was a really, really special place to be. And hopefully, look, it's just one of a number of big games, big wins that we can rack up between now and the end of the season. Thanks a lot. for your time today, guys. It's been an absolute pleasure. Huge thanks to Amy Lawrence and Michael Cox. Thanks to you for listening. I've been Adrian Clark in for Stoney. Don't worry, he'll be back next time. You've been listening to The Handbrake Off, the Arsenal podcast brought to you by The Athletic.